From the 2011 BBC Proms, that most dramatic of choral works, the Verdi Requiem. Three choirs, four soloists, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra at the Royal Albert Hall. It's live on BBC Radio 3, tonight from 7 o'clock.
This is Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The film director, Hugh Hudson, had a huge success with the award-winning Chariots of Fire. But equally interesting, I think, are some of his other films, My Life So Far, Greystoke, Revolution. In fact, Revolution, Hugh, has really come in for a complete reappraisal, hasn't it, recently?
I think so, and I hope so, obviously, because it's a film that I'm very attached to, and it took me a long time to finish it because it was sent out into the world before it was finished, frankly. And we never had what I wanted on the film, the narration by Pacino, and we redid this. Luckily, the company Warner Brothers allowed us to do it, and we put it out, and I've shown it at a lot of festivals, but it hasn't been out commercially. However, the BFI are going to do, at the end of the year, a special version of it, showing the two versions together. And the music, of course, is finally being put out, and you can buy the music now.
Philip French, I think it was, writing The Observer, said that he thought it was actually a masterpiece, that having reappraised it.
Well, that's very, very flattering, but... Yeah.
It must be nice, I mean, because people probably don't realise just what part of your life goes into a major epic film like that. And for you to feel, as you doubtless did, that there was more to this film than had been acknowledged, and to get a second bite at the cherry, it must be very rewarding.
It was, because we were very wounded by what happened, you know, and it also it was made at a time of, politically, a time of Reagan, and so it wasn't the kind of fare that I think that people wanted, or certainly the public.
And it was very difficult, wasn't it, because you were under a lot of pressure, as you suggest, at the time, and Al Pacino wasn't terribly well, and it was very muddy, and you wanted to recreate the kind of dirt and ghastliness of war.
Well, yeah, the war and how life was in those days, I think. You know, before the war happens, the film sets itself up in New York. And it was highly criticised, and even on that level, that we shot it in England, we should have done it in America. Of course, nothing exists in America anymore. The accents were wrong. And yeah, but we did, to answer your question, we did. We wanted to make it dirty, muddy, rain, hell.
Looking at your career, I realise that music is very important to you personally and professionally. The music you've chosen for films has often played a very pivotal role, hasn't it? I mean, the most obvious thing, I suppose, is the Vangelis Chariots of Fire, which was a huge success in its own right.
Yeah, so the film and the music are married together in such a way that music totally enhances the film, and became a worldwide hit, of course. And you can't think of film music that, if you put the word iconic to it, you know, there are very few, but music tracks that do that.
Did you have any idea when the music came along that this was going to create such a stir?
Who never knew the film would create a stir? Frankly, you know, it was a tiny film from England costing very little, $5 million. I mean, that's quite sizable, actually. And it just sort of took off, much in the way The King's Speech has taken off now, although I wouldn't compare them exactly as films. Same period, though. Vangelis is an old friend of mine from way back. Used him on documentaries, commercials, and the issue of music was very important to my commercials, including classical music. But I wasn't really a person who was brought up with music. I've come to it myself, and through cinema, definitely, it's vitally important. Music is, obviously, goes without saying, it's vitally important to a film, to show the emotion and the fear and the drama.
Now that you have come into the world of music, there are all sorts of pieces that are important to you which do not necessarily have connections with film. And I suppose the first one would be an obvious example.
It's a beautiful piece. It's loving and gentle and hopeful and full of love, I think, you know. So it overall embraces you.
It's Strauss's Morgan. And, well, you might just give us a taste of the words to set it up.
Yes, this piece of Strauss was written as a wedding present to his wife. And it's written by a poet, a Scottish poet, John Mackay. And it's just so loving and gentle and embracing in a way. And there's great sensuality about it, I think.
With that violin that introduces it, it sort of sets the tone, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, absolutely. It draws you into it immediately. Tomorrow, again, the sun will shine. And on my sunlit path on earth, unite us again, as it has done, and give our bliss another birth. I mean, I'd like to do it with a Scottish accent, but now I know it's Scottish and not German. I'm even more attracted to it.
That was Richard Strauss's Morgan, sung by Jesse Norman with the Gewandhausorchester of Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Mazur. Hugh, you mentioned earlier on adverts, and did you sort of cut your teeth in that world before moving on to films?
No, I began documentary, really, very early on, mid-60s. Documentary, absolutely. Sponsored documentaries in the tradition of British documentary. And quite quickly, the television commercials started, and I went into that as a form of making some money, I suppose, and also it's a very good exercise, making commercials. And I use, incidentally, classical music quite often in advertising. You know, Rossini, Beethoven, very often. The songs of the Auvergne, famously. I mean, they became very famous, some of these songs. Lakme on British Airways, very famous British Airways ad.
Well, of course, the strange thing is that obviously the music enhances the product, but it does take these pieces to a lot of people who then want to know what it was. And one always likes to think that they then perhaps explore other music.
Well, it has the other side to it too. If you hear Lakme too often, you British Airways, you get really aggravated and you probably don't want to listen to it again. It's a very beautiful bit of music.
The next piece is something that I think does bear repeated listening, and you listen to it quite a lot.
Constantly. Bach, there you go, Goldberg. I can listen to it every day. I was doing a film once in Texas in the 80s, and I just, every time on the way to work and the way back from work, I used to play Glenn Gould constantly, all the time. I didn't play anything else. Nervatar of Bach.
Do you think it's something to do with the sort of perfect symmetry, which is also married to a heart? So, I mean, it's not just cerebral music, but it has such a strong sense of rightness and pattern and organic flow.
You mean it's perfect?
Yeah, no, that's right.
It is sort of perfect, isn't it? I mean, you just cannot fault it.
And do you know the film, The 32 Pieces?
Yes, yeah. Lovely film. It's a very good film. I was going to mention that. I'm glad you mentioned it. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very good film. And Glenn Gould is an extraordinary man, I think. I don't know that much about him, but apparently he used to hum all the time as he played. Must have been very difficult for the engineer.
Well, in the end, they just left it in, actually, and it becomes part of the performance. And you can detect it sometimes.
Yes. Are you saying that Gould is the greatest performer of this kind of Bach, Goldberg?
He's certainly one of them, I think. I think there are different schools, and I don't ever just say there's one, but I do think that he's up there.
Mm. Anyhow, it's marvellous. Mm.
It says everything in 1:55.
It does, doesn't it? And it covers every mood you're in as well. Yeah, you just go. It's wonderful when you drive, because it doesn't interfere with the driving somehow. It just, often music does. Mm. But it doesn't. It's so simple.
Might make you a better driver, in fact.
Yes, it could be.
The aria from the Goldberg Variations BWV 988 by Bach, played by Glenn Gould. Do you see Hugh Hudson, any connection between him and Thelonious Monk, who was also, but in another way, an extraordinary pianist?
Well, he's a genius, wasn't he, Monk, I think. Apparently he had really like, big hands. Like Rachmaninoff had really large hands. So his spread was incredible. So you somehow do things which most pianists couldn't do. And somehow, I don't know if I'm right about this, but it seemed that he used to hit certain piano keys that other people couldn't do or wouldn't do. And so it's the sort of change of rhythm to him. You know, I noticed that also with Ralph Richardson, working with him, his voice, when he spoke and spoke dialogue. He used to break the rhythm in a way that no other actor does. And in such a way, it became so individual. And it was masterly.
Actually, that's a really fascinating analogy, I think, to both Gould and to Monk. Because Gould, in a sense, breaks with convention, not just the humming, but the kind of sort of personal focus he brings to the music. So it's all fascinating to hear that about a great actor.
Yeah, he did it all the time, and it was absolutely fascinating. You know, you didn't want to interrupt him. You thought, why is he saying something like that? Why is he putting the stress there and breaking the sentence up? But then it was completely unique.
Wonderful piece. That was the Thelonious Monk Quintet with Straight No Chaser. And quite apart from Monk, there's an extraordinary Milt Jackson vibraphone solo.
Oh, the vibes, yeah.
And Art Blakey playing the drums, Alma Gibbon bass. I was looking through, Hugh, some of, you know, you mentioned one or two of those commercials. But when I look at the list of them, actually there was really quite a lot of iconic ones, weren't there, that somehow leave an impression in the memory, which I guess is what the whole point of it was.
Visually to leave an impression, So you, so you think about the product, I suppose.
Which of those would you say are your favourite from a kind of visual point of view?
Well, as the British Airways film was very good. I don't know if you ever saw it. You know, the world and the strange Picasso shapes made up of people, all shot from the air, most of them, and two Lakme music. And then a film for Benson Hedges, which was shot in the Arizona desert, which is very powerful, very strange, slightly surreal.
How was it that one was able to do really quite creative, dangerous almost, innovative things? Why did they let you do that?
They don't anymore.
No.
They're too expensive then. For some reason, in the 70s and 80s, there was a sort of an explosion of making these vast budget films. I mean, they were very... You could make feature films for some of the budgets we had for one of those commercials. But it was they were done for two or three different advertising agencies. One was Collett Dickinson Pierce, which was run by a man called Frank Lowe, and he was very, very supportive and a brilliant salesman of these kind of extremely visual...
He had quite a visionary take on what could be achieved, didn't he?
He did, yes. Yeah. He is a very good man.
Yeah.
And then there was another company called Bose Massimi, a man called John Webster, and there were two or three companies who were doing these very, very slightly outlandish advertising visuals, really. And they're not, you don't see them anymore. They're too expensive now, and of course it'd be almost double the price now. So certainly, it's a completely changed industry. But they liked me because I had a great visual sense, and I achieved a lot by doing them. I learnt a lot. I learnt a lot of my craft before I made a film, my first feature film, Chariots, in the end of the 70s. So that's where I cut my teeth, so to speak, documentaries and these ads.
When you came to make Revolution, you used a contemporary composer for the music.
John Corleone, American contemporary.
What brought you to that?
Well, I heard his music on a film called Altered States, Ken Russell film. It was a very powerful, frightening music. The film is pretty frightening, but the music really enhanced it. And I needed I wanted a classical composer, frankly, a concert composer. And I liked his work so much. And the editor we used on Revolution was a man called Stuart Baird, who had worked on Altered States. And we talked about it, and then we got in touch with him. And he produced this extraordinary music track. It's a wonderful piece of music. And the piece that I think we're going to play is...
Well, he must have liked it because he incorporated it into his first symphony, didn't he?
Yes, he did. His first symphony after the film. And he called it a lament for his friends that had died of AIDS. And it's in the first symphony. I think it's a central movement. But we had this battle scene in the film, which was cut, and we showed it to him. And we didn't change the film at all. We showed him the piece of music, which is, I don't know how long now, it's about 6 minutes long. And he just scored it. And it's a remarkable piece of film. There's not a word of dialogue. 6 minutes silent. The film is like a silent film, bizarrely. At one time, I really wanted to do it as a silent film, but it wasn't very well received, that idea. And the battle, anyhow, it's a central battle between the British and the emerging American nation. And it's how it descends into hell.
That's quite a long queue, isn't it, in film parlance?
Enormous.
Yeah.
Not a word.
And
it's
what a wonderful...
screams and guns and the juggernaut of the British pounding down. You know, it starts off very full of hope for the American nation, and then this juggernaut appears and just smashes them relentlessly down until they run away.
Was it, Hugh Hudson, the strength of the music that gave you the confidence just to let that run?
It was edited first. After we shot it, 5 days shooting, whatever it was, in Devon, the editor put it together and we made a few adjustments and we just left it. We edited it once and that was it. We never changed it. It just was an instinctive bit of visual editing. And we said, well, this is how the film's got to be. I mean, in the script, it was like three lines, you know, much to the annoyance of the producers or the distributor, because, you know, three lines, the battle should have lasted, you know, 30 seconds maybe, or a minute. But here we felt it was necessary to see these two sides and how they were treating each other.
That was John Corigliano's War Lament from the Revolution soundtrack. The National Philharmonic Orchestra was conducted by Harry Rabinowitz. The next music, Hugh Hudson, has a double significance for you, I think. A personal one, but also the composer was important in one of your films.
Well, Elgar, yes, Elgar. England's Elgar. The Majesty of England, and which, of course, starts one of my films called Greystoke, where it starts in it's actually Scottish, it's the border region of England, in the landscape and this house and this world and this family, which is what the film is about. And we started off with the opening of Elgar's first symphony, which is not the piece I want to talk about. But this is the Dream of Gerontius, I think is the most wonderful piece, apart from the fact it was my mother's favourite bit of music. And the piece we're playing was played at her funeral. So it has a very strong emotional, personal connection with me. But Elgar, too, I suppose, I think he's a very... tender composer, and it affected my film Greystoke enormously.
The moment we're going to hear, Hugh, is towards the end, isn't it, where the angel sings softly and gently, "Dearly ransomed soul, in my most loving arms I now enfold thee." It's a sort of rising up.
It's sort of giving yourself up, isn't it, to the end of life, I suppose, into the judgment of God, I suppose, if you're a religious man, but woman, in my case my mother, she was very religious. She was a convert to Catholicism, and how it was played on her funeral. It's very moving. Itself is very moving. Strange Elgar, really. I mean, because he can be so heavy and pompous and at times, but this is the most beautiful piece.
The Final Moments from The Dream of Gerontius, Opus 38 by Elgar. Dame Janet Baker was the angel with the CBSO chorus, chorus master Simon Halsey, and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra conducted by Simon Rattle. I know you wanted to have next, Hugh, some Ravel followed by some Stravinsky. We haven't quite got room for the Stravinsky. Why did you choose the Ravel Daphne and Chloe music?
Well, it's part of the fact that it's so alive and harmonious, really.
It's also an extraordinary evocation of sort of sunrise, isn't it?
It is. Not only sunrise, but the burgeoning love. And I used it on Greystoke, which was actually when the boy is growing up, and the baby that's been taken by the apes, and he's growing up in the jungle. And we use this over a series of dissolves as the child gets older and older, sort of growing up into life with the apes in the case of the film. It was a soundtrack that we'd put together. My brother, actually, my half-brother, John Warwick, had put it together for me. And he's a musicologist and was a music critic.
Yes, he was, yes, many years.
Opera critic, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I brought him in to try to compose a soundtrack made out of existing music. That's how I wanted the film to be. And we had wonderful music, including this, Elgar, of course. Mm-hmm. Both those bits of music we're playing are in the film. But we came up against the American studio, the film in Hollywood, when we had this track, they showed the track. And they didn't get it, you know. They felt it was going over the heads of the public, it was too intellectual. And it was thrown out by them, and I had no control. Except that I did say there were two or three bits of music I'd absolutely insist on keeping in. One was the Elgar, which you hadn't heard, but the first symphony, the opening of the first symphony, which opens the film. And then when the child is taken by the apes, he grows up, and this is the bit of music we're going to hear in a minute. And it was thrown out. And it seems to be the case always with them. They will not accept... Except with Stanley Kubrick's films. I think he has complete control. He had complete control. Existing music, classical music, which is, why not if it works? And it certainly worked for Greystoke. Strangely, film composers like John Williams and Bernard Herrmann, they take the great themes, and correctly. It's not stealing, but they adapt them and they use them in the right way, and they're great composers. Bernard Herrmann is a great composer. Psycho, I suppose Stinsky. You could say the Rite of Spring, sort of. Not quite, but almost. Yeah. Boom, 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 it goes. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure where those stabbing strings come from.
Actually, that was a brilliant piece of the way he did that.
Brilliant. The stabbing strings of Psycho when she's being stabbed in the shower.
But I think what is wonderful about this opening is the orchestration. It is just staggering. I mean, the flutes flutter and the light just beams through.
Exactly. And that's how we used it. And that's what you see in the film. You see that. But it itself, a bit of music, it's wonderful. It's so uplifting.
You know, people always talk about the sort of orgasmic climax in Tristan, in the Prelude to Tristan, also in Tchaikovsky, Romeo and Juliet. But that's a pretty big kind of orgasmic climax at the end there, isn't it?
Yeah,
he holds it back, too.
Yes, he just holds it. It's in suspension, isn't it?
Levé du jour from the Daphne Sinclair Suite No. 2 by Ravel. We heard the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. And, oh, now, here, this would be somebody who would draw out the orgasmic quality, conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
Oh,
the
yes.
Schola Cantorum,
well,
directed by Hugh Ross.
Leonard Bernstein, well, he's American.
Yeah. But he did quite like to milk things.
Yeah, well, West Side Story is great.
Yeah.
But anyhow, look, it's very sad. I get very angry. It's happened twice on films with me. I made a film called My Life So Far, and that was had a Beethoven, because it's a boyhood story set in Scotland. It was about his father and him, the story, and he was obsessed by Beethoven, and he's playing Beethoven all the time. So we had a very strong musical track written and adapted by Colin Matthews, and Simon Rattle actually would conduct it, the orchestra. And it was a very interesting track, right through the film, in various moments, not carpeted through the film, but every now and then through the film. Beethoven was a very strong participant in the film, naturally, because that was he was a character. Mm. And it was thrown out by Harvey Weinstein. Dumped.
I do actually remember Colin Matthews' utter despair at that, because he was...
Well, he would have been, and I couldn't do anything about it, and I felt awful, you know, having gone and commissioned him. Anyhow, Rattle said to him, oh, well, you know, that's Hollywood for you, you know, you have to expect it if you work in films. And, but we retained a little bit of it, but not much. It's very, very sad. But that's what they do over there, you know, they rip you apart. And you put all your life and soul into something, and they say, you know, your taste isn't right, you know, not for us.
Well, where you got it right, Hugh, for them and everybody else, as it happens, is with our next composer. Indeed, we mentioned him earlier, Vangelis, of course, who had huge success with the Chariot so far. But it's not that that you've chosen.
No, I didn't. I've known Vangelis all my life, literally, since the late 60s. All sorts of films, commercials, documentaries. Amazing man to work with. You show him an image, and he immediately gets on the keyboard, and he does it. I mean, his instinctive understanding of visual imagery and, you know, and structure and all that. This piece of music that he recorded 10 years ago, he wrote for NASA, commissioned for the mission to Mars, and commissioned by Peter Gelb.
Now at the Met.
Now at the Met, yeah, exactly, and NASA. And he performed it in the Parthenon, in an arena near the Parthenon, with the Parthenon in the background. And it's magnificent, and it's a typical Vangelis, but not Chariots of Fire.
Thank you.
That was the fifth movement from Methodea Music for Nasa by Vangelis. We heard Jesse Norman and Kathleen Battle, no less, with the London Metropolitan Orchestra and the National Opera of Greece Choir, conducted by Blake Neely, and Vangelis himself was playing the keyboards in his own inimitable style. Finally, Hugh Hudson, on the sunny side of the street. What made you want to end on this note?
Oh, it's just so upbeat, such fun and alive and wonderful singer, of course, Billie Holiday. I mean, I might have chosen Strange Fruit, but this is more...
Well, that's pretty haunting, isn't it, Strange Fruit? Whereas this is more uplifting.
Yeah, this is very uplifting. It's a good thing whoever listening to it this morning will be singing when they're doing their whatever they're doing.
Making their lunch.
Making their lunch, exactly. And I'll be walking down the street and driving home with this ringing in my ears.
Grab your coat and get your hat, leave your worry on the doorstep, just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear a pitter-pat? And that happy tune is yours still. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade, but now I'm not afraid. This rover crossed over. If I never have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. Gold has set my feet on the sunny side of the street.
That's the last scene of the film I made in Scotland called My Life So Far, which we talked about. It's the last scene with this boy and his father. And it's a Sunday, and the boy is not turned up for church. The father's played by Colin Firth, actually. And he goes back to the house, and there his son is sitting in an armchair with a cigar and a glass of milk in a brandy glass and looking at a picture of a nude woman. And he's playing Louis Armstrong, singing Sunny Side of the Street, because it's a summation of what the whole film's about, the sort of battle between the father and the son. And he's coming of age, you know, this boy. He's grown up. And Colin is absolutely remarkable in the film, because he comes in, he sees his son, he's got a cigar, he's got a brandy glass, and he's got this nude on his lap, and he's playing this jazz, which he's forbidden anybody to play during the film. And everything is on Colin's eyes and face. All the emotions pass. How he finally accepts that his son, and he's amused by it, and he just tiptoes out, backwards, out of the room and closes the door. It's a beautiful ending. Anyhow,
well, that was a beautiful ending too. We heard Billie Holiday with the Eddie Heywood Trio and On the Sunny Side of the Street, the McHugh Fields number. Well, Hugh Hudson, many thanks for sharing these glimpses into how music filters into your life and onto the screen too.
Thanks a lot.
Hugh Hudson was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear an edition of the programme from 2005, when Michael's guest was the great travel writer and war hero Sir Patrick Lee Fermor. He died last month, aged 96. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Sarah Cropper. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the music this afternoon on Radio 3, much of it from the BBC Proms. We'll be live at an event just across the road from the Royal Albert Hall later this afternoon for a preview of the main event in the hall tonight, a look at the architecture and context of Verdi's Requiem, which you can hear performed live at the Proms later this evening. We'll be crossing to the Royal College of Music to hear examples played live by members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra in a Proms Plus Choral Sunday event. That's at 5:15 this afternoon. Next, though, we head to Iceland to hear music from the Renaissance recorded at the Skalholt Festival in Iceland, music from Italy and Spain by Ortiz, Frescobaldi, Pici and many more besides. That's all to come in the Early Music Show after a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime. It's read by Lopa Katari.
The King and Queen of Norway have attended a memorial service in Oslo for the victims of the bombing attack and shootings on Friday. Norwegian television reports that another person has died in hospital, bringing the total to 93. Investigations are continuing at the scene of both attacks. The business secretary, Vince Cable, has blamed what he called right-wing nutters in the United States for refusing to reach a compromise over the country's debt crisis. Senior Democrats and Republicans have failed to reach agreement on whether the federal government can borrow more than its current limit. And Vince Cable has acknowledged that growth figures for the UK economy due out on Tuesday may be disappointing because consumers are reluctant to spend. He said if demand continued to be weak, there would be pressure on the Bank of England to continue the policy of quantitative easing to stimulate the economy. Rescue workers are continuing to search the wreckage of a train crash in eastern China in the hope of finding survivors. At least 35 people were killed and more than 200 injured in the crash near the city of Wenzhou. One train stalled on a viaduct after being struck by lightning. A second train then ran into it, pushing four carriages off the bridge. At least five Yemeni soldiers have been killed by a car bomb in the coastal city of Aden. Witnesses described how the bomber drove a car or pickup truck through a military checkpoint before crashing into an armoured vehicle. The attack targeted a military convoy on its way to fight militants linked with Al-Qaeda in a neighbouring province. Egyptian security forces have fired tear gas to disperse protesters in Cairo. Demonstrators say they were pelted with stones and bottles by people loyal to the country's ruling council. It's the second time in 2 days that crowds have attempted to march on the council's headquarters. And finally, the weather. Most places will be dry with sunny periods, but eastern areas, Northern Ireland, West Wales and parts of the southwest will be cloudier. That's the latest BBC News. The time is 1:02.
Lopa, thank you very much. Well, in an hour from now, a chance to hear the prom given last Thursday evening. The Halle Orchestra was joined by the pianist András Schiff to play Bartók's third piano concerto. Also on the bill, Janáček's Sinfonietta, and to begin the music of Sibelius, a suite of historic scenes, as he called them, and then a performance of his 7th symphony. Mark Elder conducts, and you can hear that concert at 2 this afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. But now it's time for the Early Music Show, presented today by Lucy Skeeping.
Hello. On today's programme, music from a concert recorded at last summer's Skalholt Festival in Iceland. This historic village has been a religious centre since the Middle Ages, and its cathedral, perched high above the magnificent expanse of the river Kvitau, plays host to many of the festival concerts. This one features just three musicians, one Icelandic and two French, and they're performing Renaissance repertoire from Italy and Spain. So a bit of a pan-European feel to the whole thing. First up, a short three-part courant and balletto by Bartolomé de Selma y Salaverde, who was a pretty well-travelled musician himself. Born in Spain in the 1580s, he spent a couple of years as a bassoonist in Innsbruck in the chapel of the Archduke Leopold, before moving on to Venice and finally to Poland. He's not a composer, I must admit, that crops up much on the early music show, but he certainly wrote some good stuff. So here are Steinen and Björn Stephansdottir on the piccolo cello, Maturin Matarel on the bass violin, and Brice Sailly on the harpsichord.
Thank you.
Music by the Spanish composer Bartolomé de Selma y Salaverde, performed on two ancestors of the modern cello, Steinunn Arnbjur Steffensdottir on the piccolo cello and Maturin Maturel on the bass violin. And with them on the harpsichord, Brice Sailly, part of their concert recorded last July at the Skálholt Festival in Iceland. We'll be hearing highlights from that concert throughout today's programme, and more from the same composer now, with three short dance pieces thought to have been written when Salaverde was in Austria in service to the Archduke Leopold. A galliard and a dance entitled Vestiva a Colli, which seems to translate as Getting Dressed in the Hills, presumably the name of a traditional song, and an intriguing one at that. But first, a canzona.